Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen, and on today's show, we got part two of our interview with Tom Terwilliger and Joey Fulco. We had part one, of course, up last week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So we're continuing our discussion with Tom and Joey. Last week, of course, they talked about competing as teenagers in the New York area and training at Steve Mihalik's gym. And what was the other gym? The one that Tony Pandolfo was at. I can't remember right now. But this week, Tom and Joey talk a little bit more about bodybuilding and how they see today's bodybuilding compared to the old days of bodybuilding. Talk a little bit about Joey Fulco's daughter, whose name is also Joey, J-O-E-I, and the whole family is accomplished musicians, and they have their own group, sort of like the Partridge Family, where the whole family sings together. And Joey Fulco, Joey's daughter, went on a show called The Voice earlier this year, and she made, I think, the top 17 out of like thousands and thousands of competitors. Joey talks a little bit about that. And he's also got a great story about Serge Nubre, meeting Serge Nubre when he was a teenager. He went over to Belgium and did some posing exhibitions with Serge Nubre. So we got a lot coming up in our interview with Tom Terwilliger and Joey Fulco. All right, before we get to that, I do want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, so what else we got going on? Got some emails that we'll read in a second about last week's show with Tom Terwilliger and Joey Fulco, part one. And I'm going to read an article again. We haven't done that in a long time, but I was just the other day browsing through one of my old Muscle Builder magazines that was laying around. This was from August 1977. And Rick Wayne, who I've been trying desperately to get on the show and still have not been successful, Rick has kind of dropped off communication. I was talking to him a little bit by email, but he's not answering my emails for a while. So I don't know. I'll just keep trying. But anyways, I saw this article written by Rick Wayne called 1977 More Is Not Enough. And it's all about the prize money for the 1977 Mr. Olympia contest that, of course, Arnold and Jim Lorimer were promoting, and how some of the other competitors who were going in the contest were complaining that they weren't getting enough prize money. So they had a little meeting that they talk about in the article between Arnold and Rick Wayne and some of the competitors. So it was really, really interesting. And of course, Rick Wayne, great writer. You're really going to enjoy this article. So I'm going to read that article as soon as our interview with Tom Terwilliger and Joey Fulco is over with. So don't turn off the podcast. Keep listening. And you're going to hear this really, really great article by Rick Wayne from an old 1977 Muscle Builder. All right, I do want to give a shout out to our competitors who are in the John Hansen Fall Fitness Challenge, because we are now, of course, a week into November. So let's see how many weeks we got left. We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about 6 weeks left. Yeah, so we're like halfway through. We're at the halfway point of the Fall Fitness Challenge. and our guys are doing really good. So I'm on them every week to send me their measurements and send me their weight so I can track them. And if they're getting stuck, which some of them are, you know, kind of reaching plateaus right now, which is usually what happens, I will redesign their diet, make some changes. And of course, I'm writing up their workouts each week, and we'll just try to keep them going so they make progress each week. That's the goal. We want to make progress each week. So by the end of the 12 weeks, we're showing some really, really great progress. So all the guys are doing really good. They're all being really good with sending me their measurements and stuff every week. And they're also sending me their workouts. So I'm redoing their workouts each week. So it's going really good. Congratulations to all those guys. We're halfway through and they're all going to be in fantastic shape for the holidays, which was the goal of the Fall Fitness Challenge. And of course, we will have another fitness challenge coming up in January. I will announce that pretty soon. That was our biggest one of the year so far, was the one we did in January, because that's when people are really motivated to do this. So we will be doing another one in January. Hopefully we will even have a bigger one than we had last January. So stay tuned for information on that. I'll be announcing that probably in December. And I do have some new programs available on my johnhansonfitness.com website. I've got a specific program for guys over 50. So if any of you guys over 50 want to get in shape, I've got a 12-week program on there. You can check that out at johnhansonfitness.com along with some of the other programs I have. I also have a specific program on designing a training program for you if you're using the MP6 workout, which is a book that I wrote. It's available on Amazon. It's also available on my website. The MP6 workout is a specific workout for building up your power and then building up your mass. So it's a 6-week program for power, a 6-week program for mass. So if you go on the johnhansonfitness.com website, I do have a specific program available where I will design the program for you, including the weights you're going to use, how many reps, how many sets, everything. So I'll have it all written out for you. So that, of course, is on my programs on johnhansonfitness.com. So check that out as well. All right. I was able to do a really good interview this week with Mario Nieves. If you're a bodybuilding fan, you remember the name Mario Nieves. He was from the Chicago area. Mario was actually the very first bodybuilder I ever saw in person. I think it was like 1976, 1977. And we talk about this in my interview I do with Mario. He was the first guy I ever saw do a posing exhibition, a real life bodybuilder. So Mario went on to win the Junior Mr. America contest that year that I started bodybuilding in 1977. And he competed in the Mr. America, had a really good amateur career. And man, he looks fantastic. He's 72 years old. Actually, we did the interview with Mario on his birthday. And he turned 72 and he looks like he's 50. He looks amazing. So we had a really great interview with Mario. That'll be coming up next week after we finish our interview here with Tom Terwilliger and Joey Folco. So stay tuned for that, guys. Next week, you're going to really enjoy that. All right, let's get to some of these emails from last week's show, of part one of the Tom Terwilliger, Joey Folco interview. On my Facebook page, Tom himself, Tom Terwilliger, said, "This was one hell of a fun interview. Thanks, John Hansen. Joey Folco was an awesome teen bodybuilder, but decided to pursue his true passion, which was music. I admire and respect that tremendously. You may have watched and cheered for his daughter on the last season of The Voice. It was a pleasure to share the podcast with him." John Taylor, who was the teenage Mr. USA winner the year after Joey Folco in 1980, and we just had John on the show not too long ago, he said, "Two great bodybuilders from Long Island and first-class acts. Mr. America Body Shop had a monopoly on the Team USA back then. Joey Folco won in 79, and I trained there, and I won in 1980. Crazy workouts, but hard to argue with the results. Great memories, and I wouldn't trade the experience for the world." Mark Martinez, another former guest that we had on the show, said, "One of the best podcasts yet, John. I messaged Joey earlier today telling him how enjoyable it was to hear Tom and him trade stories and the internal drivers that made them who they were as teen champions and as successful men. Both Tom and Joe were guys with an innate sense that bodybuilding was a stepping stone to bigger things. In a recent podcast, I believe it was Lewis Howes, the guest mentioned people with learning challenges being on the spectrum in some way, be it autism, ADHD, Asperger's, dyslexia, or what have you. who do not fit into the box our educational system is set up to move through the pipeline, and had researched that an overwhelming number of successful artists, business, and entrepreneurs had learning, quote, disorders, unquote, and behavioral challenges. It was these very challenges that forced them to develop workarounds and create, through necessity, their own system of learning and societal navigation. No surprise, Tom is a leader in the motivational arena, and Joe is a superior musician and father. Looking forward to part two. Then Mark said, Joey Fulkel, your story and Tom's are powerful and very inspiring. Cole Alexander said, two such positive people, great hardcore champions and people. Thomas Shaw said, this was great. I love the old school stories. I'm from Piqua, and Tom got me into weight training in 1986 when he came to our school to talk about the benefits of it. My friends and I started training that afternoon after we got into Iron Master's gym right next to our school. Looking forward to part two. All right, that was cool. And I also put the interview on my YouTube channel, which is under John Hansen. And I got a few comments there. A fight fan said, I love these Legends podcasts, John. I'm 61, and I remember all the guys. Please keep them coming. The Spritz said, the best content and interviews of any bodybuilding channel on YouTube. Tony Ruggiero said, John, you should bring some of those old warm-up suits and put them on the market. I love those things. Luco said, an interview with Victor Richards would be awesome. Yeah, I'd love to interview Victor Richards. I don't see him on Facebook, so I don't know how to get a hold of him. TP said, great channel, John. And Philip said, thank you. And I did get an email. If you guys want to email me, you can email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will read your email on the air. We didn't get an email about the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, but I did get an email about training, so I wanted to read that on the air here. This is from Barry Lacey. He says, hello, John. Thank you for the info you've put up on the net. I send you this email from Australia, and I'm age 75. I was a late starter to physique development, not starting until I was 35 years old. I have two questions, if you wouldn't mind answering, please. One, the three key exercises you've recommended: bench press for pushing muscles, barbell rows for pulling, and squat for lower body. Would it be enough three times a week for me for maintenance of what I've gained? Yes, those would be three great exercises, but I think you could actually add probably some more exercises. If you're going to go 3 days a week, you would probably be using just moderate weights. If you're going to go a little heavier, you could probably cut it down to 2 days a week. What I would do is add a few more exercises, like some abdominal exercises. You could definitely add some presses overhead for the shoulders. If you wanted to add a few arm exercises like curls and tricep extensions, maybe just two sets each. But yeah, if you were just going to do three exercises, those would be the best ones: bench press, barbell rows, and squats. Like I said, moderate weight 3 days a week would be good for maintaining. But if you wanted to take it a little bit farther, even at your age — I don't think you're that old, only 75. I think you could maybe add a few more exercises, like I said, overhead presses, or maybe dumbbell presses if you're having some lower back issues, maybe some abdominal exercises, and a few arm exercises I think would be good. And then maybe if that's too much for 3 days a week, you could do that twice a week. And then question number two, did you ever work out over the years? If there is one particular exercise that is the best to guarantee filling out the upper chest rather than just having across the chest flat, even if the lower is well developed. I have not yet worked this out for myself. To me, a protruding chest and flat stomach are the ideal, and one of the ways to get this is to have the chest completely filled up. Well, of course, any kind of incline press is great for the upper pecs. Incline barbells, incline dumbbells. Incline flies are also really, really good. A lot of people don't do dumbbell flies anymore, but I always thought that was one of the best exercises for developing the chest, whether you're doing the flies on a flat bench or doing them on an incline bench. Weight is not as important as just doing the right form. You want to keep your arms really straight. The elbows aren't locked, but your arms are really straight. The arms stay in the same position all the way through. Same as when they're up as when they're down, and that'll work your upper pecs. The incline flies will really work your upper pecs. Also, dumbbell pullovers are really good. Another exercise that a lot of people don't do anymore. I like doing them where my upper back is on the bench and the rest of my body is off the bench. So I'm perpendicular to the bench, holding the dumbbell overhead. Again, you don't have to use a lot of weight, but you want to lower it all the way to the level of your head and your shoulders, and then bring it up. And when you're bringing it up together over your chest, it really gets your upper and inner pecs in a way that very few other exercises do. So that's another really good exercise. So yeah, definitely add some incline presses, add some incline flies, and finish off with some dumbbell pullovers, maybe two or three sets, and that should really get your upper chest. All right, Barry, thank you for that email, and keep training. 75 years old, that's awesome. Started at 35, it's never too late. All right, so that's all I got for our intro. Here is our interview with Tom Terwilliger and Joey Fulco, part two of our interview. And as I said, right after the interview, I'm going to read this article from the August 1977 issue of Muscle Builder Magazine, so be sure to stick around for that as well. All right, here we go.
You know, you talked about the difference between you had went over to World Gym. And I remember when I was out in California, I did the same thing. I went to World Gym. I trained for about a week or 2 weeks there. I didn't like it for some reason. It just was a weird energy. But Joel Gold had no music in that place. There was no music.
No music.
Right. You're right. You go in and you were trying. I remember Lou Ferrigno was training in at one time. He didn't need music. You couldn't hear it anyway. But the guys were training and they were focused, man. They were focused. The music was loud at Gold's Gym. I resonated with it a little bit more. I still got into my focus. I still got into my zone. But I do remember that World Gym, no music, no screaming, no yelling. Hey, maybe there's something about this. What's this gym now that promotes no sweating, no screaming, no grunting?
I have a question.
Planet Fitness?
I have a question for both you guys. I know it's not my interview per se, but something that's always – I wanted to ask champions like both of you guys, if you could go back in your career when you were preparing for a show, like maybe one of your big shows, like the Olympia or the US, the America, whatever, would you do anything different of means? Would you say, like, is there one big thing you did that you change?
Yeah, I've got a comment on that. That I think for me, what I've come to learn as well is that a lot of times we put more stress on ourselves than necessary, and stress creates more cortisol. It is detrimental to the body. It's detrimental to the mind. And even at that point, you know, and we talked about this earlier, that how serious it was in New York. I mean, when we were training for a competition, it was deathly serious. You know what I mean? Unlike out in LA. And I came to discover why those guys looked so good, and yet they were giggling, having fun, messing around with people in the gym. Is because they were lighthearted about it. There's a part of our unconscious mind that avoids things, that wants to, like naturally avoid things that could be painful or harmful, or we take it too seriously, you know? When we giggle, when we laugh, we have fun, we tend to excel more. And I think the body recovers faster. So I think for me, I mean, I remember one time I was talked into going to the movies. I think I was training my second year for the Nationals, where I took second place. And my girlfriend at the time was like, can we do something? Can we just go to the movies for crying out loud? Because I didn't want to do anything. Nothing. You know, you're training for a contest. You don't do anything. And she says, can we just go to the movies? I said, all right. And I remember I was out far enough out that I could still eat popcorn, but no butter, no salt, no nothing, right? So I had like this little bag of popcorn that I'm as long as I can bring my popcorn. I'm waiting on line. And the guard says, you can't bring that in. What is that? And I said, it's just a bag of popcorn. I said, I've got a condition. I can't have the salt. I can't have this. You can't bring it in. And he was like all adamant about it, right? So I'm like, well, let me see the manager, right? And you know how this is like those guys that would erupt in the gym. And here I was. This is the guy. So the manager wouldn't even look up at me. She's like, no, you can't bring it in. She's doing her thing. No, you're dead. So I literally pushed the guard against the wall, opened the bag, put it, and I smashed popcorn all over the guy's head, right? And walked out. And we never went to the movie. It was like deathly serious. It was like I would kill somebody rather than smile. So what I would do differently is find a way to enjoy the process more, to have fun with it, to not take it so seriously, to know that, hey, you know what? By enjoying it, by having fun, by smiling, by engaging other people in it, I'm actually going to excel. I think I would have done better. Yeah. I would have been less stress on my body and less stress on my mind. Yeah. So that's probably the one thing. There's little things, of course, but that's probably the one thing I would really, I think, could make a big difference for me at that time.
Tom, it's weird. I was thinking the exact same thing before you answered that question. I think it's the same thing. You have to enjoy the process. You know, if you look at the movie Pumping Iron, look at how they contrasted in that movie the difference between Arnold training in sunny California, having fun, running along the beach, training with the girls and stuff, and then Lou
right.
in Brooklyn in that little dank gym, and he's like super, super serious, you know, like serious as a heart attack. and look at the difference in how they approach that contest. But yeah, I agree with you. If you could just enjoy the process more and not realize that it's so, because like you said, when you put that stress on you, it increases your cortisol levels. And I've done a lot of shows. I've probably done 50 shows, and there's some where I did really, really good. And the ones I did good were the ones where I was more relaxed. And I just said, I'm going to train for this thing, and whatever happens, happens.
And isn't it like that in everything in life, enjoying it?
Yes.
I the reason why I asked the question is, in retrospect, I was miserable being a competitive bodybuilder. Because I do everything. Like, I've learned a long time ago, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. That was kind of I do that with everything. I still do it today, even with my music. And I enjoy it now. That's the difference, what I do. But I put so much into it and so much neuroses and work, and it's got to be in. I think I lost the sense of enjoying it.
Yeah.
And feel like I didn't like going to the beach. I didn't like the sand. I didn't like getting the sun. I didn't like the oil. I didn't want to schmooze and talk to you. I just wanted to fucking work out. But I was good at it. So when you're good at something, you want to do it because, oh, my God, you're going to win the A. You're going to win that. And I didn't want any of that. I wanted to just win a teenage title. When I kept hearing the Teenage USA, Teenage USA, that was it. Maybe it was tunnel vision. I don't know. But I asked that because it was exactly what you just said. Mm. If I could go back, I think it would have taken more of a lighthearted, light-spirited approach to how to do it and how to win. I don't know if that would have been possible because I think then everything was like, come on, these kids are coming out of the woodwork. Cesar Giuliani and Mike King, all these guys. And I remember seeing him in the books. I'm like, I could beat him. I know I can beat him, you know. And you get caught up in it.
Yep.
But I don't think – I mean, there was a time after the America, I think it was, Teenage America, and I was just miserable.
Yes.
I walked in – I had a bodybuilding gym, East Coast Health Club. We opened it up in 1980.
I remember it.
Yeah, so unhappy. I went to the gym, real quick story. 4 o'clock in the morning, I put on 135. I put on some music. I had a little coffee. Went there. I did, I think it was 3 or 4 benches to warm up. And I remember sitting there, laying down around that, and going, man, I am so unhappy. And I put the bar back. I shut the lights. I walked out. And I said, man, I just want to play guitar. I don't want to do this. And I just opened the gym.
Wow.
We just opened the gym, and I was like, Joey Volko, teenage bodybuilding guy. That was going to be kind of the promotional outlook to get people to come in, which they were coming in anyway, but I just couldn't do it. But you hit it right on the head, Tom, right there.
Yeah, and you did too. I mean, it's just like that is true for everything in life. And you know, I got to go back to and again, listen, when I heard that your daughter was on The Voice,
right,
and competing, and I had to watch. You all had to watch. I mean, there's so many of us that just were. My in-laws, who have no idea who you are or who Joey was, were rooting for her because, number one, she really looked like she was enjoying the process, always smiling, always having fun. But she really looked like she was in the moment, you know. And I don't know what took place backstage or what her actual experience was or mindset was, but it was in addition to her performing at her best in many respects, I'm sure there were moments when it wasn't her best, but it also allowed us to enjoy her performance more.
Yes.
You know, had it been so, imagine she was like we were when we were bodybuilding, like this, I'm doing what I love, but I'm freaking miserable doing it. You know? I remember one time my ex-wife actually told me, she goes, you are a miserable bastard. I was just training for a contest. That's all I was doing. I'm a miserable bastard. I'll never forget that, man.
That's what we do. We're miserable. Let's get over it.
Yeah, get over it, exactly.
You'll never be a champion. You'll say that.
You're too happy. You'll never be a champion, man. Hey, John,
getting on The Voice was a cool thing. That was quite the journey.
Yeah.
It took her since she's been singing since she's 2 years old. Wow. So to get on there. And look, John, you're a world champion. You understand what you got to put into it mentally.
Yeah.
And to get up there and sing and have people like you, it's suggestive like bodybuilding. Look, you're a perfect example. Like, you know, we all are. You get on stage, you have a lot of time invested, you're dieting, you're posing, the thing, the mental aspect. Now you're saying to the judges, hi, like me.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they don't like you for whatever reason, they're not going to pick you.
Right.
It's not like you're going to hit a home run and win the game.
Right.
She's singing and they're saying, like me. Yeah. What if you don't like that type of voice?
Yeah.
I don't think it's about better. It's just what it is, you know, and you know bodybuilding is like that.
How did she end up doing, Joey?
She came out of 55,000 people. She made it to the finals, to top 17.
Okay.
And then she got off the show right around that point, and the phone started ringing for everybody to book her. And then COVID hit. Because it was during the middle that she had to film some of the shows at home. Mm. And they're like, there's no gigs. They're like, we want to sign you, but we wanted you to go on this. But then that got canceled. And everything just came to a screeching halt.
Wow.
Screeching halt.
Damn.
Which was so hurtful in its own ways. But I took it. Look, let me tell you a quick story. So the last show, they're going to tell her that she's off the show, right? And she's standing up to this way, if I can show you. And all I see is the back of her. Now, I'm in my kitchen. You can't see me on camera. And the host of the show, Carson Daly, says, the person moving on is, and he waits for the, you know, the excitement. Goes, Joanne, whatever her name is. So Joey didn't move on, so Joey was off. And two things happen. Carson Dalen says, wait a second, they're telling me in my phones, and they cut the feed. That was suspect to me. But the thing that got me was I saw my daughter's shoulders go from here to here. Mm. She was depleted. And I know that feeling. And you and Tommy, I know you know from losing a show that,
yeah,
that thing, okay? And she had that. I never felt so much angst and hurt in my life for her.
Right.
That's my daughter, right? I know how much work she put into it. Okay. She didn't go on. So the show's all over, camera's going dead, go black. She's hugging me. And I'm like, Joey, and she's like, I'm sorry. I'm like, sorry, don't ever, ever think you owe anybody an explanation. Sorry for nothing, little girl. You did amazing. You should
be proud. She was amazing.
I'm so proud of you on levels I can't even tell you. I wish I would have had the talent you did to even get that far in a singing competition, even though, and I was just explaining to John, Tommy, about it's up for suggestion because it's like you put on posing trunks, you get up there, you're like, please like me. Really? The judge doesn't like your look, just the way it is. You're not going to hit a home run and win the game or score the touchdown. It's singing is like that. Either you like it or you don't. And you're being judged on that prowess of what you do. So after the show, she went out and then she came back and there were a couple of days. I said, okay, here's the rule. And I'm installing this at the dad. You can feel sorry for yourself one more day, and that's it. Now back to work. Mm-hmm. He said, you got to have 2-3 days. I get it. But you know what? We're good now. No more. Get your ass back in the studio. We got gigs. Now you got to be a champion.
Right.
Pick yourself up. No more. You're done. And that was it. That was the end of the crying and the feeling sorry and the whole concept.
Yeah, and you know what? Part of the issue is, and again, listen, athletes, bodybuilders, all sorts of athletes experience this. We give it our all. We've got a really great shot. Maybe it was, hey, you were anticipating, if you're a physique athlete watching, you were anticipating winning a national championship, winning a USA, doing something, and life was about to change radically for you. There was no going back the pursuit of this goal. It's going to be accomplished. And suddenly it's not. And we all have that experience. Anyone who competes is going to have that experience where it didn't turn out the way we wanted it. And we've got to be able, like you said, pick yourself up by the bootstring. Hey, you can whine and feel sorry for yourself for a couple of days, but then you got to get back. You got to find that motivation to get back into the gym, get back into the studio and pick the pieces back up and continue to move forward. Because there was a plan before that. Before that opportunity showed up, there was a plan. It was something. I want to achieve this. I want to do that. And it's just like, hey, you know what? This shouldn't be the end of it by any chance. But I will say this, that number one, we were really proud and excited, you know, to watch your daughter and watch her do so well. But I really feel bad that she was, in many respects, denied. I don't want to say robbed, but denied all those opportunities that would have been there had it not been for this disruption, you know?
And that look, and we spoke about that in depth, and I say, look, you're not the only person who was hurt or affected by this pandemic, whatever you want to call it. And we never, ever, as a family for entertainment, have a political agenda. It's just not what we do. So you keep that to yourself if, in fact, it's important, unless you have a soapbox to stand on and you're going to live it. We don't do that. We get on stage. We sing songs. We want to make people happy.
Awesome.
That's it. We don't do it. So I said the best we're going to do is follow the rules, stay safe, and let it take its course without us being, you know, that person that's going to change the course of history because of a pandemic that hit. We can't do it. That's not what we do. So we stand clear of it. And so I said, think about how many other people are affected by this. I said, you didn't win a show and you might not get to go play live somewhere. I said, that's light in the concept of people who maybe died or lost family members or lost tragic. I said, so how dare you? How dare us all to have any sad feelings? We did well. Our family did well. We supported each other. The journey, which this is all about, has been so robust with so many wonderful things. We did great. And you know what? You had a glorified commercial on NBC for 8 weeks, right? Right?
You so really did.
So use it to your advantage, and you get to always say, "Hey, I was on The Voice." Now let the journey start again. Let's continue.
Right.
When I lost my show in 78, guys, I was devastated. I was devastated. I could, because I, like you just said, how you have a concept where you're going to go, everything's behind you, here I am, I arrived at this moment, well, I'm going to win, I'm going to be champion, boom, I lost. Casey Karachuk, am I saying his name?
Casey Karachuk.
Yeah. He won that year.
He was good.
So he was great. I lost in 78 to him. I couldn't believe I lost. I shouldn't even been there in retrospect, but my mindset believed I could make it, and the next day I came back, I started training for 79. But I told her that. I said, do you really think champions are made by winning? I said, champions are made by losing. That's what champions are. So then you use that to your advantage. Then there'll be a time for you to fit into what you're going to win or whatever you got to do. So but understand the distinction between winning and losing and getting involved. Because you could – I know people who would be afraid to even consider getting involved in something. And they don't do it. That's a loser. Yep. I'd rather see you go into it and lose. That's a winner.
And for your daughter to get up. And, you know, when we talk about the experience of losing and the lessons that come from that, what makes you a champion, if you're willing to get back up, continue to move forward and keep fighting, right? Losing in front of or failing in front of a few hundred people or even 1,000 people. But having the guts to get up in front of, and I gotta imagine she had this conversation in her own mind. It's like, this is like, there's going to be thousands of people and even millions of people watch. You know what I mean? To have the guts to get up on a stage where you can fail in front of millions of people is tremendous. And then the amount of strength and knowing the courage that was developed. And for God's sake, for anyone who entered a contest, had the courage to do it, entered an event like The Voice, had the courage to go through with it, overcame all those fears, doubt, and uncertainties, and then to have, like you said, an incredibly glorified a commercial. I mean, she is so much better off today than she would have been had she never had that experience. And I would say that for anyone who's entered the competition, gave it 100%. I mean, really didn't hold back. No holds barred. Just gave it 100%. Regardless how it turns out, whether you're dead last or you win the thing, it's all the same. You had the courage, the wherewithal, to set a goal, to set an objective, to pursue it, and found the courage to get up there and actually go for it, man. That's a small percentage of our society, unfortunately.
You're 100% right. You know, when she did the first or second show, I went to the theater before COVID hit, and I'm sitting, I'm just dad at this point, and I know I'm good on stage. I have the bodybuilding experience posing in bikini briefs in front of a couple of hundred people. That is another whole thing, right? And she comes out to sing, and I'm shaking. You got these huge stars, Grammy winning, Blake Shelton and John Legend, huge stars, and she has to sing. Now, you know, speaking in front of an audience is nerve-wracking. Now she's got maybe 800, maybe 500 people in the theater. She comes out, and it's just her and a microphone and the band behind her. And they're like sitting, turning around, okay, sing. Wow. Man, that is some huge pressure because your voice could go quivery. You could crack, you know, and you have to have you got to look this way, the stage, and this way, and you have to be composed, and you got to sell the lyric, and you got to be on pitch. There's a lot. It's not just singing.
Wow.
she was composed enough after being on stage, and she's 2 years old, where she said, to your point before, Tom, about being comfortable and just having fun with it. And she really did that.
Wow.
And I think that's what you connected with as well, because you said you could see she was having a good time.
Definitely. No question about it. And I tell you what, it's pretty admirable for a young woman of that age to be able to find that ability to be composed and relaxed. And granted, obviously, listen, there's always going to be a level of nerves, but to be able to control that, you know, and just and to be able to enjoy the process and to perform as well as she did, to be selected even number one. I mean, just regardless of winning it or not, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's just having that guts. Pretty extraordinary. There's something to be learned for all of us from that experience, man.
You know, it's funny. I learned a lot today from this whole discussion. We was talking about some older days in bodybuilding. And I follow what you're doing right now all the time. I'm always watching the videos. And I remember the first video, because I went back in your history and you had the big medicine ball. Is it called a medicine
ball? Yeah.
Air ball? What do you call that?
Football or Swiss ball, they used to call them.
Okay. And you were doing some push-ups on it, and I don't think people realize how hard that is with the constant resistance going both ways, because it is. It's not just like using a hard surface. And
right. You have to push in to keep the arms from just popping off.
It's brutal. And I was telling somebody, do you have any idea how hard that is? Like, that's real. You're not doing 100 reps. Like, that is tough stuff. You got to have – because that your shoulders and your tendons and your muscle and age creeps in because your body's like, okay, I'm good now, you know. And you, I'm looking at you doing that going, oh, my God. How is he like – because I know what it is. And I do push-ups myself off the side of my bathtub. I go on an incline, and I do that every morning. And I
right.
do other workouts, and I have a Concept 2 rowing machine over here off to the side and other stuff. And that's what I do, just to keep in shape, you know. But I was looking at you going, man, I don't know how in the world you – because I know you must have injuries. You have to have injuries.
No doubt about it. In fact, I hate to admit it, I tore my rotator cuff. And it's interesting because most of my injuries – and there's not a lot, but there's a few. And, John, I'm sure you've got a couple of things here and there.
Hell yeah.
You know, most of mine have resulted in martial arts training. I've been a lifelong martial arts since I was – 10 years old, studying Kung Fu and mixed martial arts, JKD, Filipino Cali, all these different arts. Almost all of my injuries have been a result of the martial arts stuff and not wanting to back it down, you know? And, but then most recently, since, you know, COVID, Dawn and I have been in the gym less. We've been out on our bicycles. It's been a beautiful summer out here in Colorado. We've been on our mountain bikes and we've been having a great time. And about 3 weeks ago, I went over the bars for the second time. I did this years ago. In fact, going over the bars years ago took me out of bodybuilding. That's what took me out. It was I broke the clavicle, dislocated the shoulder, compound fractured the wrist, a couple of broken ribs, and that was the end of the bodybuilding career. But I didn't learn my lesson. So we were out the other day, a couple of weeks ago, and I went over the bars again, man. Jeez. And it was one of those in the zone moments. They say, as you read about more about how to really get into that focus zone, bodybuilding, especially when you're lifting hard and heavy, there's a certain level of threat, almost a life and death kind of thing to a degree. And it's almost one of the elements required for really getting into that zone where everything stops or slows down to such a degree, time slows down. And I remember going over the bars the last week and just like, it couldn't have been more than a fraction of a second. And how fast it happens, you know what I mean? But it literally, it was like, I made decisions. Don't leave with the wrist. Turn your head. Drop the head. Leap a little bit forward so you can land on this softer spot. Avoid that rock. And it was all like going through my head in a fraction of a second.
Wow.
It was an extraordinary experience. Now I got the shit kicked out of me. You know, dislocated the shoulder again. Broke a toe. Injured my ribs. So it's been a tough couple of weeks coming back from that.
Wow.
But at the same time, it's just like, hey, I refuse to let age or anything else stop me from getting out there enjoying those things that I love to do. I mean, you can't imagine stopping playing guitaring or singing or being a performer because of something, you know what I mean? We just got to keep pushing through it and not allow. And it's interesting on Facebook, you know, just like, hey, you're too old for it's like, bullshit, I'm too old. What am I too old? You know, when I can't get on the bike, I'm too old to ride them. Okay. That's it. When I can't get under the bar, maybe I'm too old to lift. But that's going to be a long time from now, man.
No, you're incredible, man. I see what you're doing, and I know, you know, firsthand how difficult it is. But you And keep in mind, you're doing it speaking, breathing, setting a tone for what you're doing, explaining why and how. There's a lot of mechanics on those videos that you put out that you're doing. It's Thank not you. Just, you know, just run the camera and there's a guy doing a thing and you put it down and there's an narrator. There's a spirit to it all. And it's really fantastic. And, you know, you don't see enough of that. But with somebody with so much experience and the spirit of it, man, it's really, really cool to watch it. Because I can't be my age and not look at it and go, you see? Look, man, look at that guy. He won, blah, 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 and he's still doing it. He's fucking 63, 62 now. He's kicking ass. That's what I get from it. And I want to say to people, did you see what I just saw? Like, did you see that? Like, don't you think that's amazing? Like, you got to get – I'm like a kid when it comes to stuff that excites me because I'm always about – you could learn. You got to learn and be open to be better. And that, I think, what you do makes us all better.
Well, I truly appreciate that. Yeah, we all have our inspirations. I got to be honest. A couple of years ago, I went to the Olympia, not to compete certainly, but just to, you know, to spectate. I wanted to see the competition. I wanted to see the expo. And I'm walking along, and all of a sudden, I look over at this booth. I'm like, "Holy crap, that's John Hansen!" and then I look a second time. I'm like, "And he's there with Samir Banoot." I was like, "Holy crap!" I had to go over, and it was John and I had never met. We had probably conversed a little bit on Facebook. Yeah. But we never met before, and there's a guy who inspired me, John. Truly, man. I mean, what you've been able to do as a natural competitor, and even now, I mean, when was the last time you competed? It was relatively recent, wasn't it?
4 years.
Like in the last couple of years? How long?
Yeah, 4 years ago.
4 years, man. I mean, I wouldn't even dream in my wildest dream of getting back on stage. It was like, no, not gonna happen, man.
But you know what? I don't understand. I've seen a multitude of his photos. Can't understand that guy, John. You're natural, and I'm looking at you going, wow, I would never, never have believed that in a million years. I would have said, bullshit, don't tell me he's not taking Adderall, don't tell me he's not taking, you know, propionate, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, and it's not, it's true, man. I'm like, wow, that's so serious. I'm not that it diminishes the, like you said, the guy who takes the stuff, but man, that's quite an accomplishment to go dry.
Thank you.
It really is. Had an advantage to some degree, you know, understanding that you didn't do. And listen, and when I turned pro, my perspective changed a lot because I started competing with all these European guys, and I was spending a lot of time in Europe and training with some of these guys. And they would look at what I was doing and be like, what? This is it?
Yeah.
Whatever accent, they're Italian or German or Swiss. This is what you do? This is it? Yeah. This is like what I do off season. This is your contest, bro.
Yeah.
Hey, you want to hear a great story, guys? We're talking about the 70s, right? Listen to this, John. You're gonna love this. I win my show, and they send me out to Belgium and to France, and I'm gonna do a posing exhibition, and it's gonna be this thing from the Teenage Winner, and they put me with Serge Nubre and his wife Jacqueline at the time.
Wow.
Now I go to his house. And we're hanging out together, and I go to his gym, and I'm representing the United States for this thing that's going to happen. And it was in Liège, Belgium. I'll never forget. I go, they send me there. What happens is I'm at Serge's house, and I think I'm not sure if I slept over that night, but I was there for a while. I was there for a week or two. And he gets up one morning, and I'll never forget this. He's eating. He has a big cup of coffee. Now, traditionally in Europe, they have the small little –
Right, a little espresso,
a big cup. And he has these rolls, and they're like regular bread rolls, not croissants, but rolls. And he's dipping them in, and he's eating, and there's a hole. And he said, oh, you can have them. And I'm looking at him like, I don't understand. What are you eating? He's like, oh, it's the roll, and whatever. I'm like, well, don't you do eggs? He says, well, what do you eat? And I'm like, well, I'm eating chicken.
Egg whites.
I'm egg white. And he said, you should have this. It's okay. And he lifts up his shirt, and he's ripped to the bone.
Man.
And he said to me, I'll never forget. He goes, can I ask you something? I said, yeah, because it was kind of like we had just met. We were really getting friendly. He says, well, what do you take? And I said, well, Anavar and Dianabol, and every so often I take Synthroid or Thyroxin, whatever. He laughs. He goes, no. He says, let me show you what you need. Goes inside, and he brings out Plethrol, Triacana, and all these exotic thyroids.
Never even heard of this stuff.
Yeah, the kind that you got to cut the top off with a saw. They come in a flat box about the size of this, actually about that size.
Mm.
Top is the powder. Under it is the solution, I guess the saline, whatever it may be. And in the middle is a little baby saw this big. And what you do is you take the vial and you saw off the top. It has like a nipple tip. And you crack it. You extract it with the syringe, pour it in to the vial of powder and shake it. You got to wait. Then you take it out. And you take the drug. He also gave me this, it's called, that was Plethrol and Triacana. And he says, let me give you the cream. I said, the cream? He said, yeah, it's called Triacana cream.
I remember
like
that.
Astringent, and you put it on areas like between the bicep and between the pec. And then he gave me all this other exotic steroid stuff that wasn't never necessarily like a thyroid, or thyroxine or thymine, mucase. And I went home. He sent me home with a suitcase full of these drugs. Listen, I took out all the drugs from the sheath it was in, and I rolled them up in my socks. And I went out and bought more socks, and I put them in the socks. So no, and I rolled them up, and I had them in my suitcase. And I came back to the United States with all these exotic drugs. And this is – I'm not ashamed. This was what it was.
Yeah.
He said, you take those – and you could eat all the bread in the you want in the morning. And that was like the holy grail. I'm like, I can eat bread and butter and dip it in my coffee.
Bread and butter.
True story. He was, because I saw him eating. I'm like, it can't be. Because you're ripped to them. In my mind, I'm like the egg whites and you can't have any sodium. And
yep.
This is what I'm drinking. And I had to stay somewhat in shape because I was doing a posing thing.
Oh, hell yeah.
I have the Chevelle, which is horse meat and the fries and the frites and all of, you know, that's, I'm in France. I'm in Belgium. This is what I want to have.
Right.
You know, because I heard of these wonderful foods. And it was my first trip to Europe. And he sent me back all these drugs. And I couldn't believe it. His wife was beautiful and stunning.
Yeah, she was beautiful.
Oh, God. She was equally as in shape. I'm like,
oh, she was good. She had a great body. She was always in great shape. I'm a little envious. I always wanted to meet Surgeon Gray. I mean, that guy was like a movie star out there in France and Belgium.
We trained in the gym, and he turned me on to all those exotics. And I forget. I think it was called – oh, you know who I met? Yeah. What was the name of the cologne? Oh, God, it was a cologne that Paco, started with a
Paco
P.
Paco Rabanne.
Paco Rabanne was a chemist. He's the guy who gave him all that knowledge and drugs.
Wow.
So I met Paco Rabanne, and he was the guy who was supplying and making all that stuff.
No kidding.
And that was it, Paco Rabanne. And that was like, he was there. And I met with him, and all it was craziness.
That was the thing. If you got an opportunity to go to Europe, and I didn't until later in my career, I was in Belgium as well, spent some time in Belgium. Did the Grand Prix tour, went all over the place. I'll never forget the Grand Prix tour, man. And again, listen, I hope we're not giving too much away, but I don't think any of this is trade secrets by any means.
Trade secrets.
But I remember competing in the Grand Prix after the Olympia. And we did seven countries. We did Sweden. We did Germany. We did France. Seven countries in like a week and a half. It was ridiculous. It was grueling. It tested your mettle. You know what I mean? And but I do remember, man, and I had no clue. I was clueless. And that, the bus, we were always on this big bus touring around, right? We slept in the bus, we toured on the bus, we ate in the bus. And I remember in Italy, we pulled up in front of this drugstore, this pharmacy. And it's almost like everyone knew but me. Like, what are we doing? I mean, they literally, like, everyone just piled out, piled into the drugstore, and came back out with, like, shopping bags of stuff. And I'm like, what the hell you got there, man? He's like, oh, yeah, this and this and this. And I was like, oh, my God, you got to be kidding me. I'm like, am I missing out on something here? What's going on, man? I mean, everybody knew. And it was just like, that's what they did, because these guys had been there before. I'd never been there before.
Yeah.
So I didn't know this was the deal. Again, it wasn't – yeah.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask you, do you think there was a time, Tom, when you abused the stuff?
One time. And listen, I guess that's perspective too, because anybody, there might be those that would say any use is abuse, right? I mean, there are those that are that conservative about that and have their thought about it. And I understand that. I get it. But I will say this, the second year, after winning the national championship in 86, I competed in the Night of the Champions. I came in sixth 90 Champions. It was a big introductory show for a lot of new pros. We competed. Mike Ashley, who I beat at the Nationals, beat me. Gary Stridham won it. And I was still on my normal, let's call it my recipe, my normal, you know, intake of the anabolics. And it was after that show, it was just like, then I got to meet a lot of the Europeans and stuff. And again, like I said, I showed these guys, we got into conversations. We were like Barry DeMay, for example. And we were talking, and they're like, looking at what I do. This is what I do. I didn't do anything all year. 3-4 months before competition, that was it. Right? I was clean all the rest of the year. And they were like, this is what we do off season. We ramp it up big time before competition. So I was like, holy crap, this is what it's going to take, you know, to get to the Olympia level and compete, you know, for sure. And so I did for that next year. I did all that. And I got to tell you, it was the worst I ever looked, worst I ever felt, ever. I mean, I couldn't get rid of the water retention. I looked bloaty. Granted, I was, you know, I got up to, by the way, you guys, I don't know how you guys got so big. I was never able to get, I think I'm about roughly the same height, but I was never able to get over like 215. Off season, like 215 was it for me, man.
Oh, really?
I never competed on stage at more than like 197, maybe 200 pounds, you know? But that one time when I did too much of that year, I learned a valuable lesson. I said, it isn't about this, you know, for me. It was about the training, it was about the nutrition, it was mastering the mindset and all that. So it turned out to be a mistake for me to do too much. My body rebelled. It developed receptor affinity, and it just wasn't. Instead, it was just shit floating around in my body, looking for a home and taking on the form of estrogen. You know, it just wasn't good, man.
I remember taking. There was a time when it got away from me, the concept of what it was, and I think it was a lot of because ignorance, obviously, and youth and inexperience, and I was taking a lot, man, more than, I mean, I can't believe I'm here, a lot. That's that stuff. And I had a connection to get it was unparalleled, anything. And I remember saying, you're only taking 20 to edible. Someone was like, take 25. I mean, I'm not kidding. And I remember Seba was the company who made the D-Bowl.
Yeah.
We were buying so much that we couldn't get the Seba. You had to get the alternative, which was the fake stuff, we used to call it, which didn't work as well. It's not the same. And no one's going to tell me it is. It's not. If it wasn't the real D-ball from Seba, you know, and the real testosterone, the propionate, cypionate, and the Anavar, and the Winstrol V, and all that crazy stuff. And then a Seclin came out. We used to put it in the arm. And it got to be craziness. And then I remember reading, and somebody said, I think it was Mihalik, well, you know, steroids make cells grow. And it hit me. I said, well, it's not prejudiced. Cancer cells.
That's right.
So it's not saying big muscles, big biceps, big, you know, it's everything's going to grow. And that was when I put the bar down at 4 o'clock in the morning in the gym. I think between that and wanting to do music, I said, you know what? What am I doing?
Yeah.
And I got to be 248 was my biggest. And I never had a problem growing. Granted, I was fat. But big fat, like bodybuilding fat.
Sure, a lot of muscle off season. Yeah,
I was eating, I could grow, but it did. I couldn't breathe. I remember sleeping one night, this thing, you know, and I said, man, my heart must be just like, well, and I thank God I said, you know, Hail Mary, fall. I'm done, man. I can't do this. I'm killing myself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you hear the stories of people we know we lost, you know.
Oh, I know. I mean, I retired in 91 after the Olympia and that Grand Prix tour. That's when I broke my arm. I moved to Colorado, broke the arm, and just rocked up my body. But it was like 92. It was like around that time, 92, 93, 94, that guy started experimenting with different things, you know, insulin, IGF-1, the growth hormone. Growth hormone became the staple. And again, you know, go back to that idea that, you know, it's non-discriminatory from a cellular growth perspective. Yeah. And even in many respects, growth hormone reproducing cells.
Right.
And again, if you've got cancer, and I've had bouts of skin cancer that I've had to deal with and continue to do so. That's like, even today, as a mature adult, a lot of, you know, hormone replacement therapy clinics talk about growth hormone. Quite frankly, I'd love to be able to do minimum doses of growth hormone right now at 60 plus, because I know it can be beneficial. But that whole idea of expanding cancer cells at a much more rapid pace is just not worth the price, man.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys didn't survive it, you know. A lot of guys, especially with the insulin and stuff at that time.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm glad I got out before all that became really mainstream, because I don't know, I might have experimented myself, you know?
You know, even today, I got to say, I speak to old 70 bodybuilders because that's really my connection. I didn't have much in the 80s because I was out. Nobody really, really talks about what, in fact, they were taking back in the day. You could ask a whole bunch of bodybuilders, and it's still kind of a moot subject. Mm-hmm. Where they're not really saying, I took X amount of this, blah, 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 blah. They're not laying out a recipe of what they did.
Right.
And even now, I'm like, I wonder what he was, because I never did growth hormone. That, I never got that far. When I started hearing about it.
Expensive.
Yeah, I never did. I did what I did and what I had, and it worked. I got in and got out. Because I was only in it from 76 to 79. So I was good. You know, I got into other things, but that I was done. So, you know, every time you hear champions like yourself and other guys, like even John Defenders, we would speak about it back in the day. But I never really talked to anybody say, what exactly were you taking?
Right.
It always seems to be a gray.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've experienced that yourself.
I have, actually. And there was a period of time that, because I was living in Manhattan at the time. And this was, you know, the the late 80s, early 90s. And there was stuff that was coming in, you know, to New York that a lot of guys just from California and New York were using and experimenting. We still don't know what it was for the most part. There was stuff called balasterone and quinolone. Do you remember some of this stuff? And these things were like bathtub creations that were pretty amazing. And you felt like you had a cutting edge. You know, you were on the cutting edge. But it was like, I don't know. What the hell is stuff worth? And it was like you experiment with it, and then you're like, I'm just going to stick with what we know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, recipe-wise, how much, how little. I still have journals. I used to keep journals every competition. I have a stack of journals down in my basement somewhere. The training, the diet, the anabolics, everything, mood, mindset. I kept track of everything at that time. Of what was going on. I felt like, you know, if you could journalize it, if you could measure it, you could improve it. So I could look back from one contest to the next and say, here's what worked, here's what didn't work. We need to change that. Let's get rid of this. Let's replace it with that. We did overtrained. We didn't get enough cardio, all that stuff. So I have all those. I could look back at them and be happy to share some of those recipes. Although, you know, it's probably not something I would recommend for anyone at this point, you know what I mean?
That's the fear, I think. That's the fear, is you don't want people. Well, he did it. You know, I still hear people not in the sport professionally or competitively taking stuff. And I'm such a proponent of do not take this stuff for the reasons you speak about.
Yeah.
And I can't be an advocate big enough to say, guys, you're going to get hurt with this stuff, man, especially today. With the way things are made chemically, everything seems to be chemically enhanced or induced. I'm not so sure even organic has a viable word, is a viable word any longer.
Right.
So I say, you know, you got to really be careful. You be taking stuff. What's the reason to walk around and go to a club?
I mean, I know that's
not that competing justifies it, but you really got to be careful with this. And I know from what I was taking, man, I could have killed a horse with the crap. And I'm not proud of that by any stretch.
No, of course not.
Because I put the work in. I did the hours and the twice a day and the 7 days a week. And I did it, man, for 4 years. But I remember stuff I was taking now. If you told me, I would be like, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine. Today, not a chance. And I would discourage anyone from, you know, listen, I love the route that John took. And it shows that it can be done without that kind of support. It's difficult. It's much more challenging without question. But the advantage that guys have today, outside not being able to find a damn good training partner or some good coach. A lot of coaches out there hanging their shingle up and don't know what the hell they're doing and will just push the anabolics on you. Is the advantage you have today, you have much more refined supplements. You talked about earlier, Joe, you know, Bob Hoffman's desiccated liver. I mean, we had no refined protein drinks. We used to blend up Bruges, desiccated liver, peanut butter, raw eggs, whole milk, and that was a protein drink, man.
It was a protein drink.
And I tell you what, man, you didn't want to be in the house with, I mean, bruised yeast and desiccated liver is not the best thing for, like, keeping a spouse
or a girlfriend around. No, man, you're going to let people know what you were drinking. Hey, I have another question if we have time. You guys don't mind. John and I were speaking about this earlier. Tom, what is your take? And it's such a hard question, I'm sure, but because you're going to rat hole yourself here, but what do you think of the new bodybuilders? compared to the older guys. I might be older. I mean, with all respect, I'm going to say 70s, 80 guys.
Real classic, you, man, classic, yeah.
Classic. It is totally different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly.
The shows are different, but I get into that every time.
Absolutely. Well, certainly the bodybuilders today, I mean, it just, and let me preface this with, at the time, you and I and John and everyone else that was competing back in the 70s, early 80s, even into the 90s, we all had one mentality. It was like, it was almost a bury me massive mentality. It was about getting big. The reason we got under 300, 400 pound squats and did multiple reps and sets was to get freaking big. We wanted to define, we wanted to shape, we wanted to, you know, create aesthetics at the same time. But it was like, you wanted those aesthetics as big as you could possibly be. So if we could have been, could you imagine being, you know, looking like one of the today's bodybuilding champions back then? I mean, you would have dominated, you know, granted it's not as pretty, but you would have dominated because you're just so huge and muscular and just crazy over the top. You know what I mean? So I can't criticize them for wanting to be like just freaks. And that's what they're pursuing. They're becoming freaks in many respects. Guys are at my height, 5'9", 300 pounds.
It's like, we would have done that too. Look, you know, if one of those guys walk into 1978, 79, if you could have looked like that, you would have done it in a heartbeat.
And no question.
I don't take anything away from these guys. I think the classic physique is a thing of the past, at least now.
Yeah.
But I see these new guys, and I'm thoroughly impressed because I don't even know how.
I don't know how they do it, what they're doing. And they seem to have gotten this whole belly, this distended belly thing. Yeah, they seem to have gotten that a little bit under control. I don't know if that was a growth hormone thing, but what was going on. But it was really, it was like for about 8 or so years or so, it was really bad. I think they've gotten it under control. I don't know how. I'm not involved in it at the moment, right. You know. But so beyond that,
What would do that, Tom? What would make a belly protrude like that?
Growth hormone, IGF-1, insulin. The growth hormone for sure. Because keep in mind, again, if you're working your abdominals hard, right, and that muscle is growing, it's getting thicker and thicker and thicker and thicker, and ultimately too much for the transverse abdominis to even keep retained, you might say. So it just starts to push out like a belly. And the intestines are growing. Cellular growth happens everywhere. Cancer cells, muscle cells, intestines, all that stuff. When you're doing massive amounts of growth hormone, IGF-1, and insulin, could easily expand to that level. So I think they've managed to pull it back and find a way to control it and still be big and muscular. So, I mean, these guys, I don't admire the physiques. There are some that are just like, dude, that's ugly, man. I don't dig it at all. But I will say this, that the introduction of the classic physique division, you know, the whole physique division with the board shorts and the low legs,
yeah.
I have a hard time admiring it. The upper bodies are fantastic, great.
I don't get that at all.
Yeah, I don't get it. I love their abdominals. They look great, you know, in a pair of jeans. Yeah. But the classic physique division, I think, is these guys look pretty good, man. I look at some of these guys in the classic physique, division now, and I'm like, jeez, I don't think I could have beat that guy. You know, I mean, there are some guys that are really good that haven't even won pro shows yet. You know,
right.
So I listen. I guess it is what it is. It's got to evolve. These guys have to become monsters. We expect it every year. They got to get bigger and bigger and more muscular and more muscular. I don't know where it ends. You know,
why did they lose the posing aspect? You don't see the classic. Look, half the show now, right? Forget about the competition. Half the show is showing what you've done. That's the whole thing. If you're not showing it, why are you fucking showing up at the competition?
Absolutely.
You're supposed to pose and have the thing. Is it just standing like a grunt? I mean, it's like they're sending a fucking photo.
Yeah. They're standing like a grunt and then like, okay, give it to me. No. Show me something more than I've just saw with the last six guys.
Right.
Show me a presentation that knocks me on my side. Show me a presentation that sends shivers up my spine. Like the first time I saw Ed Carney pose, I was like at Pumping Iron in New York City, the premiere. Ed Carney pose, and I was just like, I got shivers up my spine. That presentation, that movie, literally, I was a 15-year-old kid heading in the wrong direction with the wrong, bad self-esteem. I saw that movie and it changed everything. That's I saw amazing. Ed Carney and it made the decision in me. I want to move people like that. I want people to have that same reaction I have. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to explain why that has disappeared.
I think they stopped judging the posing for the pros, and I think everything goes down, you know, like, because we were inspired, like you said.
Trickle down.
Yeah, you were inspired by Ed Corney. You were inspired by all the pros. And when we were teenagers, we looked at all the pros, and they were great posers.
Mm-hmm.
So we all wanted to be great posers. And now I think the pros, for the most part, are terrible posers.
I don't think they work on it at all.
No,
again, maybe because it's not part of the judging. I don't think there's any real effort put towards it at all.
No.
A couple of guys like Kai Greene, there are a couple others. I hate to say that I don't know who they are, but I'm sure there's some that are really making the effort to make that happen.
But
since they took that away, that judging criteria, and it's work. I remember I've been complimented, you know, not to blow my own horn, I've been complimented several times on my 91 Olympia routine, that it may be one of the best routines in bodybuilding history. And I'm excited by that, that people still remember it.
Yeah.
There was a freaking lot of work, man.
Right.
I mean, I spent months putting it together, picking the music out, and you know, mastering it, man.
That was so part of the sport. Look, I call it a sport, right? Because it is a sport. So to me, that's part of it. It's like today when you see pitchers, they don't do the windup anymore. They just go right for like they're in the side. That's it. It's like, what happened to the finesse of let me show you? And even some of these competitions, it's a cattle call because they got 125 guys come in. None of them even get to show what they've done.
Nope.
That is so unfair and unreasonable to me. These people work hard. They paid their money. Their family came out. They all got hotels. They're in there, and they walk out, and they walk off and say, okay, you didn't make it. Get the fuck out of here. I'm sorry, man. It pisses me off. I saw my daughter last year because I hadn't been to a bodybuilding show in 20 years. And I saw that, and I was like, well, isn't he going to pose? She's like, no. He just can't. I'm like, that's it? He broke his balls all this time dieting and killing himself for that?
Give the guy 30 seconds. Give him 30 seconds at least. Come on. His family's here.
Right.
Let him show a little bit. You know what I mean? Yes.
I agree.
Yeah. And the other thing that I don't like about today's sport, you know, is the when did this start?
Yeah.
When did we start standing like this? I mean, what is that? Is that even remotely aesthetic? Is that like, is that even remotely natural looking? I mean, look at back to the guys like, you know, even the Olympia, you didn't see Samir Banoot standing like that. You didn't see Sergeant Bray. You didn't see Arnold. You didn't see Lee Haney. You didn't even see Dorian Yates, who was the gatekeeper of the next generation. You didn't see him standing like that, bow-legged like I just got off the horse, like somebody's holding her arms up with strings. I mean, what? I work with a young athlete today. You guys, good. I discourage that. He can't do it because everybody's doing it. I'm like, don't do that.
Your lats are too big. Come on, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
There's 6 feet between your arms and your lats. Your lats aren't that big.
Look, you guys both hit it on the head, and I got to tell you, man, I think of those. You could call it classic days or golden age. For me, it was golden age, and because I got to live it and be in it and be a part of it. I know the stories I have with Halleck and the insanity. As crazy as it was, I still believe it was a more romantic time for physique and bodybuilding.
Yeah.
And you knew the players. It seemed to have a different, like Robbie Robinson. I saw him training at Gold's Gym, and I was amazed. He was like a star.
Yes.
I don't see that today. And I'm not trying to diminish today at any stretch. But when I saw, like, even Lou and Sergio Nobre and Cal Skalczak and all these, my God. They were like rock stars.
Yeah.
But there he is. Oh, my God. Like, this skin had a different hue to it.
Yeah.
It was like more of this golden thing. I can't put my hands on it, but it seemed plastic-like. Like another world. I was so intrigued by, I want to be one of those. I still call it a muscle man. When I was a kid,
enamored.
I wanted to be a muscle man.
Yep, absolutely. I tell you, man, my first time. Number one, the first time I could beat an Olympic, but the first time at the Night of the Champions. And again, like I said, I think I was six that year. I was competing as Robbie Robinson, Bertle Fox.
Wow.
And I was like, dude, I was literally backstage. I'm like rolling up. I'm like, oh my God, freaking Bertle Fox, Robbie Robinson. I mean, literally, I'm looking around for somebody to put oil on my back. Robbie Robinson was the nearest guy. Freaking Robbie Robinson put oil on my back. I'm like, that was like, the contest was over. That's what I told my friend at dinner. I'm like, Robbie Robinson freaking put oil on my back, man. I mean, it was just like, these guys were stars. They were like, they were legends. You know what I mean? To compete with them, just even to see them was like, wow. Today, it's like, there's so many. Number one, there's so many. And they come and go. I mean, they get like, they look like monsters. And within a couple of years, they're gone. You know, it's just like, we don't really have a time to even follow them. They disappear. And then the next guy comes in, you know? I don't know. It's a different world. It's not as romantic as it used to be. No question.
I can't believe you talk about being competing against those guys. That to me is such a cool accomplishment to say that. I mean, look, to be on the stage and in the back room with those guys, because, you know, when we grew up, you talk about Night of the Champions and all those other shows and legend. Robbie Robinson is a legend. I mean, you got to hang with him and level.
So it was so cool, man. Because I remember going to see one of the first Night of the Champions. Joe Nazario was competing in it, Robbie Robinson. Let's see, who else was there? Danny Padilla. Mike Mensur was competing. I think Mike Mensur might have won it. Dennis Tenorino. All these guys that I grew up watching and looking at and reading about in the magazines. I was like, oh, my God, I'm in the audience watching these guys. And then later on to compete against now. Granted, Robbie was on the end of his career. So was Bertel Fox. Albert Beckles.
My God.
I was a teenager, and I went to see Albert Beckles, the guest poet in some teenage contest in Connecticut. You know what I mean? Yeah. And he gave me his autograph. I flexed his arm. I was like, oh, my God, it's freaking unbelievable. And here I am. I competed against Albert 3 times. He beat me twice. I beat him 1 time. And it was just like, freaking Albert Beckles, man. I was still like a 15-year-old kid, honestly. Yeah. It was amazing to me. It was a different time, no question, man.
All right, guys. Well, I'm going to let you guys go.
What? We haven't hit the 3-hour mark yet. Come on, John. We got more stamina than that.
You got a lot to say to the world.
Yeah, we're going to have to bring you guys back for sure.
Well, thank you for having me personally. I know I'm honored when Tom hit me up. I'm like, wow. First of all, to reconnect with him and do this it's an honor and a privilege and a pleasure. And you as well, John, you've always been a gentleman and you're amazing. And I got to tell you, man, you should be really proud of everything you're doing too. Cause you got, both of you guys, man, it's wonderful stuff that you're keeping this alive.
Thank you, Joey. Thank you for coming on again. Great having you on the show again.
No doubt. John, thank you so much. I mean, it's always a pleasure. You are in yourself a legend. You share the history of bodybuilding on a weekly, daily basis with your show. Your experience. You have some great guests on, present, company excluded, except for Joe. And Joe, because I've been a guest on John's show a couple of times, and when he approached me for this one, I was like, hey, this is exciting. This is cool. I love being on the show. And he said, hey, do you think you can get a hold of Joey Fulco? And I was like, huh. I said, that'd be fun, man. Sure. Let me reach out. Let me see if I can get a hold of him. And actually, it was supposed to happen last week, but I was caught up. I was doing what's called the Comeback Strong Summit last week. We had 22 amazing speakers from all over the world, and we were raising money for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. We did really well. I was very excited about that. So I let it sit for a couple of days, and then John reached out again. Hey, were you able to reach Joey? And I said, no, not yet. Let me try him again. Let me see what I can do. And it was cool. It was kind of a fun honor because, again, watching your daughter, watching your career, seeing what an amazing musician you've become, mentor, father, and bodybuilding legend. So it was really a pleasure, man. And I can't tell you how much fun it's been just sharing the little bit of limelight we had here together, man.
Thank
it was
you
awesome.
So much. You guys are absolutely wonderful gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
All right, guys. All right. Well, we'll definitely have you guys back because we got a lot more stories to tell, it seems like. So, honored talking to both of you guys again, and I appreciate you joining me on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast.
You got it. Hey, guys, one more last thing real quick. I just want to address the audience listening real quick. Hey, whatever your dream is, whatever your goal, whatever your desire might be, you can make it happen. If you're not ready to give up, not ready to quit, keep moving forward. Joey did it. Look what he's become. Look at what John's been able to do. Look what I've been able to do. We're no better, no more equipped, no smarter than you are. Whatever your dream is, continue to pursue it. Don't let any pandemic, don't let any disruption stop you. Just find a way. Remember, like the Marine said, over, under, around, or through, whatever it takes, you can get through. And that's my last message. If you'd like to connect with me more, go to maxmindset.com. I'd love to share some of those tools, rules, and strategies with you.
All right, Tom. Thanks, buddy. Well said. All right, guys. Thanks again for joining me, and we'll talk to you guys again. Take care, buddy.
Ciao, everybody. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Tom Terwilliger and Joey Fulco for joining us on the show. I really enjoyed that long interview that we did, and I hope to have those guys back on soon. Next week, we will have Mario Neves, great bodybuilder from the Chicago area, one of the country's best top amateur bodybuilders, and he was the Junior Mr. America winner in 1977. So we're going to be talking to Mario next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring the show. I also want to thank all of our Patreon donors who are contributing each month to keep the Bodybuilding Legends show going. I really appreciate you guys. If anyone out there is interested in being a Patreon donor, just go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link where you also can contribute, if you wish, and be a Patreon donor. All right. So before we let you guys go, I'm going to go back to reading an article here from the 1977 issue of Muscle Builder Magazine. It is written by the great Rick Wayne. And the title is called Mr. Olympia 1977, More is Not Enough. According to persistent rumor, Arnold and Jim Lorimer picked up over $60,000 at the 1976 Mr. Olympia. Now some people are set on sharing the Mr. Olympia cake. It started harmlessly enough as a mere insinuated après neuf pares gym locker room soup con. A silly germ of an unfounded rumor, really, barely audible to the naked ear, as they say. But hardly had a few days limped lazily by than the mainly ignored hint of a saboteur's dream had permeated the sacrosanct, carbolic in-between sets atmosphere at Gold's. Finally, to explode and spread to muscle environs as far apart as Vince's in North Hollywood and Pearl's in Pasadena and BJ's in Calgary, Alberta. Oh yes, even from Woodland Hills, we felt the rumors. But not Arnold Schwarzenegger. He who would play the lead role in the low-budget, confounding imbroglio did not hear the word, would not hear until some Saturdays later. But wait a moment. Even as devious schemes were being laid for the most pernicious sabotage since Macbeth did poor Duncan in, Arnold was busy doing more and still more double-raising things like coast-to-coast television talk shows in New York, Chicago, and Washington, D.C., rapping away tongue-in-cheek with society columnist Earl Wilson, and on Wide World of Sports, exposing himself, very out of shape, but who gives a damn, for Wythe and Warhol and Neiman, not to mention the boys from After Dark and Blue Boy and Lampoon and Newsweek and Time and Playboy and We. Then there was the obligatory all-night gourmet fest and celeb soirees at Elaine's that would lead eventually to one Globe Award, replete with hugs and kisses and a few snide asides and not-so-subtle exchanges of telephone numbers and cheesecake photos with Mrs. Ponte and Ms. Welch and full-grown variety ads, to say nothing of the never-ending publicity gigs that apparently had much to do with the current rush for tickets to Pumping Iron, of which Arnold owns a large percentage, and the putative new interest in that previously esoteric sport euphemistically referred to as bodybuilding. As I say, the boy simply was too busy to lend an ear to outre rumors, but he would hear. Two Saturdays ago, a nice warm day, I have come to Gold's, which is a little off my beaten track, I might say, to join Joe Weider for a posing session that is scheduled to include Robbie Robinson, Cal Scalak, Lou Ferrigno, and a smattering of current shining stars. Oh, yes, and photo superstar Artie Zeller. Unfortunately, I arrive late, something to do with a lack of parking space in the vicinity of Gold's, and I discover Robbie has taken his matutinal workout and posed and left for a weekend appearance somewhere on the East Coast, hot bodybuilding property that he is. Robbie does not have much time these days for lying around and shooting the gym breeze with the likes of Eddie Giuliani and Ken Kuhn and some others, who are as much commonplace at the aforementioned gym as the regular furniture there. Indeed, Artie has taken most of the required pictures by the time I got to Gold's, which left me much time to discuss the only subject that currently and at every other time interests everyone at Ken Sprague's Muscle Building Emporium, the Mr. Olympia contest. Lou Ferrigno and Artie Zeller were having a difficult time getting a word past me when Bill Grant limped in late for the photo session. He is attired in a green visor that at first appears to be a shield from the sun, but which it later turns out is in fact a regular part of Bill's normal apparel, jeans and tight-fit t-shirt. and his face, it seems, has been twisted grotesquely into a gargoyle mask. Holy steroid. Bill Grant's lips are every bit like those of a duck. Duck Bill, did you say? Swollen and stretched this way and that, like something straight out of National Geographic. And there's a whole lot of Band-Aid and whatnot over his nose and the corner of his right eye, like someone suddenly clamped a heavy pair of thighs over the poor boy's face. Hey, ha ha ha, I say. Ha ha ha, sorry, Bill. I mean, what the hell happened to your face? He tries to answer, but somehow my ears don't hear too well, no doubt because I'm folding up like a damn fool at a circus, laughing my head off at the image Bill projects. I mean, he looked ridiculous with all that muscle showing through his T-shirt, the green visor, and that face. At last, I hear the sorry story. 2 days earlier, Bill had been beating hell out of the leg press machine, trying like the mamas to rectify whatever it is with his legs that allowed a pudgy Ed Corney to place ahead of him in the 1976 Mr. Olympia, when all of a sudden his lights went out. It turned out that a 50-pound barbell plate had somehow become dislodged from its place atop the leg press machine and landed solidly on the visage of poor Billy Grant, hence the nightmarish result. But never mind all of that. As I was saying, there we were, Lou Ferrigno and Artie and me, talking over the forthcoming Mr. Olympia contest, arguing about whether or not there should be two classes at the 1977 version, arguing about the merits of a $2,000 overall prize in the face of some $30,000 profit in Arnold's pocket, talking this way and that, when in walks the great one himself, Arnold, that is. He went straight to Frank Zane, who was standing fully dressed in a quiet corner of the gym, apparently impatiently. Minutes later, the two left, ostensibly to do some arrow shooting somewhere in Santa Monica. Archery, as Arnold put it. Archery, as you or I might say, we who are not hampered by a leftover Austrian accent. Well, anyway, as Arnold and Zane walk out, Grant comes into the Olympia discussion. Listen, he manages through bizarre lips. I think Arnold should give a whole lot more this year. I mean, last year, he and his partner made over $50,000 profit from the show. What did we get? Man, I got nothing. I feel everyone should share in on this thing. So what do you say to the idea of one winner this year, I asked. What would you say to a return to the old days when Larry Scott was the only winner, when there was no below or over 200 category, when the winner collected the whole purse? Grant looked at me as if I just stepped on his lower lip. What do you mean, he said, agonizing. I mean, Arnold told me there would be over $12,000 to be divided among this year's winners. But if you had just one winner taking home the whole damn thing, well, that'd be worth the effort of training, wouldn't it? The idea knocked Bill cold. Lou Ferrigno was all for it, not Artie. Said the photographer, no, I think like Bill. Why should all the money go to one guy? Everyone should get a little something. I interrupted him for the upteenth time that morning. Look, Artie, the guys are complaining that there's not enough money being awarded to winners. It seems to me that if Arnold gave, say, $10,000 to Mr. Olympia and $2,000 to the best poser in the show, that everyone ought to be happy. Can you think of a better incentive to train? A better incentive than $10,000? And if you don't make it in the muscle department, perhaps you can collect for your posing ability. Bill again. Why should Arnold make so much? $30,000, man, and we get nothing. Nothing. Ferrigno. I think Arnold should up the prize money to $23,000. Me. You guys seem to be forgetting that 3 years ago, the top money was a lousy $1,000. The fact that you now have over $12,000 is all due to Arnold's ingenuity, not your appearance. The man makes his show, even though he naturally needs contestants. The contestants there were in the old days, Sergio, Sipes, Poole, Scott, Arnold too. But people were satisfied with the $1,000 because everyone figured it would be impossible to raise more. If Arnold and his partner made a great profit last year, blame it on their hard work, their guts in putting out advertising money, laying their bank accounts on the line. Arnold sold T-shirts, programs, prejudging seats, and so. And I think he's done well offering 12 times as much as was offered 3 years ago. So it went until Joe Weider took it into his head to challenge me to an ego-boasting show of strength. What do you say to the boss in a situation such as we have here? I accepted, naturally. We proceeded to do one-arm rows, which muscle fans will know I am most partial to, and we worked up to 150 pounds, before Joe called a halt to the whole thing on the ground that it was beginning to aggravate his sore neck. It seems to me that earlier in the week, he had hurt that area from, of all things, jogging, which goes to show you, you can do yourself in other than by weightlifting, doesn't it? Later, Zeller and I went to lunch. Joe promised to join us, but something must have caused him to change his mind. He chose instead to go home to Beverly Hills, which turned out to be his smartest move of the day, considering the conspiracy to have him pay the gastronomic bill. Monday morning, the great one is on the line. He wishes to have me attend a gathering that is scheduled to take place at his Santa Monica home that evening. At last, he too has heard the rumor. Now he knows all about the plan to sabotage his upcoming Mr. Olympia show. As he heard it, the West Coast competitors were fixing on cornering him at the last minute prior to the prejudging and ordering him to increase the Mr. Olympia prize money by thousands of dollars, or else they simply would not appear as advertised. As they say, no appearance, no show. Holy mashed potato. After all the togetherness talk, the bodybuilding fraternity was planning on blackmail? Well, now Arnold was organizing this come together to iron out differences, to discuss the whole matter of the 1977 Mr. Olympia contest, and he wanted the affair reported. Right up my street. I was in Santa Monica early that evening. The meeting was scheduled for 8:30. First, I called on Artie Zeller. He hurried his evening ablutions to get to Arnold's in time to photograph the proceedings. But when I phoned Arnold to check that if it would be all right to have Artie to the talk session, he hemmed and he hawed and he suggested perhaps it would be best to let Artie drive over after the talking had been wrapped up. Don't ask me why. I got to Arnold's a little before 9 p.m. Present and accounted for were Robbie Robinson, Lou Ferrigno, and Frank Zane, with the great one dishing out wine this way and that. Only Lou and Robbie kept refusing. I took my glass and sat down. Zane wanted nothing changed. He felt the two Mr. Olympia classes should remain as the year before and the year before that. Again, don't ask me why. Surprise, surprise, Robbie agreed. He, who was the favorite to win outright, felt it would be nice if everyone got something out of the show. Nice guy, that Robinson. Not Lou, however. This guy is like yours truly. All or nothing is his game. He said there should be one Mr. Olympia winner and one cash prize, even though he's still plump for a few thousand dollars more. For his part, Arnold said he used to hate sharing the Mr. Olympia with Franco Colombo, but now that he was promoting, he sort of feels it's a good idea to keep the two classes. Now he was wondering whether Ed Corney's idea of having first, second, and third in both classes might be a good thing. Certainly it would mean splitting the prize money even further. He said he had a talk with Boyer Coe by phone, and Coe had said he didn't care what they chose to do. He'd be there to compete no matter what. Heavy. The prize money will amount to some $13,000 this year. How that is split remains to be discussed further. It seems there will be two classes like the year before. We left for supper at Zucky's at Arnold's expense. As Robbie ate into his tuna salad and Lou his fish and Arnold his steak, I made mincemeat of my ice cream and apple pie. Ah, the luxuries of the non-trainer's life. The conversation centered at this point on Arnold's movie career. It seems he signed a $1 million contract to do 5 episodes of Conan the Barbarian over the next 3 or 4 years. And he's apparently turned down a lot of other offers that Lou seems intent on grabbing. Moreover, Lou says that he's taking speech lessons so that he might pronounce his D's and D's better. Yes, he's into drama lessons. By this time, you may have noticed a lack of reference to Bill Grant's contribution to the meeting at Arnold's house. The truth is, Bill could not make it for some undisclosed reason. Instead, he deputized Ken Waller to speak on his behalf. Only for some reason, Waller also chose not to show up. Another notable absentee was Artie Zeller. He wasn't too happy with the conditions of his invitation, it turned out. At this point in time, the whole Mr. Olympia controversy seems to have gone down the shower drain at Gold's, and Arnold is going full steam, what pun, ahead with promo plans. Already he sold over 2,000 seats, and things are, as they say, looking good. No doubt, Pumping Iron will help pump even more dollars into the Mr. Olympia coffers, but whether or not the guys at Gold's get their way and end up with a reasonable cut from the profits remains a matter for debate. Personally, I'm taking no bets on the outcome. At the time of writing, Franco Colombo is definitely not competing this year, even though he has hinted that he might be interested in appearing for a pretty fee at Arnold's Pro Universe promotion. Arnold has invited Sergio and Larry Scott and a host of other superstars of yesteryear and today to sit on this year's Mr. Olympia judging panel. Unfortunately, a few crazies among the bunch have demanded fees ranging from $300 to $2,000 just to judge. You think it's easy? Hey, that's West Coast Indian for promoting ain't no piece of cake when it comes to muscle guys. Stay tuned, brother man. All right. Thanks to Rick Wayne for another great article from the August 1977 issue of Muscle Builder and Power magazine. I just love reading those articles from Rick Wayne. It's great to read about all those old bodybuilders from 1977. Good old days. All right, folks, that's it for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We will be back next week with an interview with Mario Nimes. Stay healthy, enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.